Welcome to the Eric Metaxas Show. Please keep your arms and legs inside the car at all times.
This is your final warning.
Now, here's your host, Mr. Thrill Ride himself, Eric Metaxas.
Hey there, folks. Welcome to the Eric Metaxas Show. I'm Eric Metaxas. This is the show. I hope you're not disappointed. Let me tell you something. The show is not about me. It's about my guests. I love to talk about all kinds of topics and subjects, one of which is science. You don't need to be a scientist to care about science. We should care about everything, learn what we can learn. And for that, I've often gone in the past to my friend, an actual scientist, Dr. Michael Gillen. And that's why he's my guest today. Dr. Michael Gillen, welcome back.
Eric, it's so good to see you. And I love your background. And it's awesome. It fits you. You know, George Washington in the background, the bookcases, the whole nine yards.
We got Bonhoeffer. It's all show business. I live in a tar paper shack down by the beach.
It's all one of those fake backgrounds people are using on the Zoom now, right?
I have to tell you, Michael, it's good to see you. It's been a little while, and I want to update people on you. First of all, most people know you. You were the science editor for ABC News for a number of years. You've written many books, and we had you come and speak at Socrates in the City a number of years ago. But you're basically a scientist who popularizes. You help non-scientists understand science, and you're a man of faith, which is originally how I met you through our mutual friend, Wes Yoder. And so I heard that you were launching a podcast, and I said, I think we need to tell people about this. So what is the name of this podcast?
It's called Science and God. It's actually Science Plus God, but Science and God with Dr. G. And it's
with Dr. G. And you're now going by the catchy name Dr. G.
Yeah.
Gillen, way too complicated.
You know, it's it's interesting because, you know, we've known each other for so long, so you know how to pronounce my name. But, you know, in Spanish, it's Guillen. And so a lot of people, especially now that I'm living in Texas and there are a lot of Hispanics here, you know, people will.
Pero estamos ahora en los Estados Unidos.
Okay?
It's pronounced Gillen.
Hey, okay. You know, that's a pretty good accent you have there, brother.
Muchas gracias. Okay, listen. We don't. I can do New York Puerto Rican accent, or I can do Castilian. Which would you like?
Well, you just did Castilian by saying gracias. That's beautiful. I love it. Yeah.
But it's just kind of funny, Michael, because when people say that, right? Like they say, you know, well, the name really should be pronounced Guillen. How do you say it?
Guillen.
Guillen.
Guillen in Spanish.
That would be like me saying, my name's Eric Metaxas, but it really should be pronounced Metaxas. But here's the issue. We're not in Greece. We're in Los Estados Unidos ahora. Okay?
Yeah, so it's true. Can I tell you a quick story? When I started, I was at ABC News for 14 years. And when I started at Good Morning America. And I remember we had a decision to make. Was I going to become known as Dr. Michael Guillen or Dr. Michael Gillen? And I made the choice Gillen because it's just easier to pronounce. And as you say, in the United States, it's the anglicized pronunciation. And then shortly thereafter, I couldn't have been on more than about a month or two. I was at Logan Airport waiting to catch a plane. And this man came up to me, Hispanic gentleman. And he said, "You're Michael Guillen, right?" I said, "Yes, sir." We watch you on Good Morning America. We love you. And he turns around to his family who's behind him. He said, he asked me first. He says, "Are you Hispanic?" I said, "Yes, sir, I am." He turns to his family and says, "I told you he's Hispanic." He says, "Hey, how come that Joan London calls you Gillen instead of Guillen?" So I made the decision right then and there, and it's been that way ever since. But I don't mind if people call me Guillen. That's okay. But you and I know each other.
The guy goes, "Estamos en los Estados Unidos, amigo." No es difícil, okay? Now listen. You and I, we need to talk about science.
Yes.
Because I always joke around with my friends too much. But Dr. G makes you sound like a weatherman. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. So you would recommend maybe we change it to Science and God with Dr. Gillen or Science and God with Dr. Michael Gillen?
That's my recommendation as your friend.
You know what?
Okay, first of all, before we get into deep stuff, if people want to find this, is there a website or should they just go to their podcast and look for Science Plus God with Dr. G? What should they do?
Gee, they can go. I think the easiest way, actually, Eric, is just go to my website, www.michaelgillen.com, michaelgillen.com, G-U-I-L-L-E-N. And then there's a button there that'll take you to the podcast. It's Access More. It's run by the K-Love people. The people who run K-Love and Earhart,
Joe Battaglia? Is Joe Battaglia involved?
No. No, but Ronnie Taylor. You know Ronnie Taylor from Earhart? What? I may be saying Earhart. I may be wrong, Earhart. Hold on. I think it's Air One. It's K-Love and Air One. I don't want to get into trouble here. I'm trying to plug some of the wrong people.
We're here to talk about science and God. We've already lost the whole audience. They have fled now because they want us to shut up and stuff. I apologize. Listen, I'm so fascinated personally with the idea that's out there in the culture, which is completely wrong, that faith in the God of the Bible somehow is contradictory with science. That's complete nonsense, but that idea is out there. And you've spent your life really working to help people understand that God and science, not only are they not antithetical, but one leads to the other, basically. So what do you do in this podcast? What's the idea behind it? What can people look forward to?
Well, I do what the title says. I talk about science, but from a Christian perspective. And I talk about the ways in which science and Christianity in particular just synergize. They not only get along, which to me is a very kind of passive form. Oh, yeah, they get along. No, it's not that they get along. It's that they inform each other. They take each to the next level. And I almost compare them to like two tuning forks, which are tuned to the same critical frequency. And when you bring them in close proximity, they don't just like hum along. No, what they do is they resonate. And so they build each other up. And so Science and God with Dr. G, the podcast, is all about explaining to people, number one, that science and God are compatible, but that's the least of it. As I say, it's more than that. So the first episode, for example, was telling my backstory, which is that I wasn't always a Christian. And you know this, Eric, because you know me long enough, but I was an atheist. I mean, when I was a kid growing up in East Los Angeles, I just wanted one thing out of life, and that was to become a scientist. That dream consumed me from about the second grade. I've traced it back to the second grade. I had clear recollections of dreaming about being a scientist. And when I say dreaming, I don't mean just like, you know, Pinocchio dreaming of becoming a real boy. I had dreams at night, and I saw myself in a white lab coat. I saw myself, you know, winning the Nobel Prize. I saw myself just doing experiments. And you got to keep in mind that growing up in East LA, it wasn't as if I was influenced by a scientist that I met. You know, my neighbor wasn't a scientist. Trust me, in East LA, it isn't like scientists are.
LA was the barrio.
Yeah. If anything, I was being recruited to become part of a gang. So this vision, I now realize in retrospect, I believe with all my heart, these literal dreams were visions that God was planting in my heart. But I didn't know that, and I didn't credit that to God at the time. I just knew I wanted to be a scientist. So I went from East LA to UCLA to Cornell and ultimately to Harvard and beyond that.
But didn't you ever think of becoming, you know, because of the gang influence, perhaps becoming an evil scientist?
Well, I'll tell you, I have very clear recollections from elementary school running around with gang members and saying, you know, curse words and Spanish curse words out loud and just being kind of a terror. So God knows. And fortunately, my parents moved us out of there when I was in third grade. They moved us out from East LA to Montebello, which was just one town over, but it was really another world. And so suddenly my neighbors were like, just,
you know what?
Very different.
I'm sorry. We've just gone over time. We're going to be right back with Dr. Michael Gillen. folks. Welcome back to the Eric Metaxas Show. I'm talking to my friend, Dr. Michael Gillen. He is a scientist, and he has a new podcast called Science Plus God with Dr. G. Dr. G, of course, is Dr. Gillen, or Guillen, right? Did I get it right?
That's beautiful Spanish pronunciation, and all my Latino relatives and friends will be happy with you.
my name in the Hispanic pronunciation is Enrique Metaca, or something like that. Metajas. Look, we're just talking about this issue that a lot of people have, and you were saying that when you grew up in the barrio, evil gang members trying to recruit you. And somehow, and I always see this as God's sovereign hand because there's no way to explain it, you knew that you wanted to pursue a life in science. And
yeah,
it's similar to me, the world I grew up in, there was no scientists, you know, to say, I want to be like that guy. So yeah, it's kind of an amazing thing that you had that early on.
Especially because nobody in my family, Eric, either, was a scientist. I mean, I'll be honest with you, most of my family never went past high school, and we have our fair of even high school dropouts. The only college grad was my dad, and he became a lawyer. And so I had no role models, absolutely no role models. So you got to wonder, where does this kid from East LA from grade two get this idea? And we didn't have TV because, you know, we didn't have a whole lot of money. So it wasn't like I was being influenced by some TV show or anything like that. But what I'm saying to you is these people we're talking about who are so adamant that science and God are like oil and vinegar and they just don't mix. And so if you're a scientist, you can't possibly believe in God. And if you're a Christian, you can't possibly be you can't love science. In fact, you know, they criticize Christians for being anti-scientific, and I hope we can get a chance to talk about that. But when I got to Cornell as a grad student, I became a scientific monk. I slept maybe 3 hours a day, and the rest of the time I was holed up in my lab in the basement of the Lab of Nuclear Studies. We called it the LNS at Cornell. And so I have empathy for these people who are so adamant that science and God don't mix, because I was that person for many, many years.
Okay, so while you're at Cornell,
yeah,
you did not believe in the Bible.
No, not at all. And my whole world was science, Eric. My whole world was science. And then I asked myself, I think maybe it was about a year or maybe a year and a half into my grad studies, I started asking myself a really simple question. And that is, how did this incredible universe come to be? Because by then I had studied the universe for many, many years, all the years at UCLA and even years before that on my own. So I was well aware by then of how incredible the universe was. It wasn't just pretty on the outside. I understood at that point how incredibly beautiful it was on the inside, through and through. And so naturally, as an intellectual, as an atheist, I was just curious. I wondered, and I know that I knew back then that science offered me the answer that it was all this magnificent accident. And I was very familiar with the equations of quantum mechanics and the quantum vacuum and so forth. And it was very elegant math. So it's very seductive. And I bought into that for a long time. I bought into the standard cosmological model. And then I just started learning more and more. And the more I learned, I realized there were holes in the standard cosmological model. And so I started exploring other things, and I got to the point where I thought, you know what, I can't buy into this anymore. It's just intellectually dishonest for me to believe that this was an accident. So then where do you turn, Eric?
Now, forgive me.
When your whole life is science, and science is failing to answer a fundamental question, what do you do? That was the dilemma I was faced with.
When you say the standard cosmological model, tell us what you mean by that.
It means that it's what most people would probably call the Big Bang Theory, but the Big Bang Theory has gone through many iterations since it was first devised in the 1940s. You know, inflation now, and now we have a more sophisticated understanding of the quantum vacuum and quantum perturbations, and now even the idea of string theory, which gives rise to the possibility that maybe not just one universe was created, but multiple universes were created. So the multiple universes, I don't want to give your listeners or viewers the wrong idea. The standard cosmological model does not include the multiple theory, the multiple universe theory. That's string theory. That's a whole different thing. So when I say the standard cosmological model, it's basically the idea that the universe sprung from a perturbation in the quantum vacuum, and it gave rise to this Big Bang, and it may have gone through an inflationary period. That's kind of the common belief right now. And then it gave rise to first atom, neutral atoms. So, you know, the first it was all ionized, nothing but electrons and protons. And then they coalesced and they created atoms, and then atoms created molecules. And then you had planets and solar systems and galaxies and clusters of galaxies. So that's what we call the standard.
It doesn't seem to me that that contradicts God, does it?
It doesn't. But I see God wasn't even, I didn't even think that way in those days. God wasn't even part of my, I wasn't even wrestling with the idea that God was or wasn't compatible. He just wasn't on my radar screen, because my whole radar screen was fully occupied by science. I mean, when I say to you that I was a scientific monk, that is the best way I can describe it to you. And when I say I slept 3 hours a day, I'm not overstating it. That's as much as I slept. And
did you drink root beer out of an Erlenmeyer flask?
Well, almost. I mean, I'm trying to paint a picture for you. Okay, Erlenmeyer, that's a good one. I wasn't a chemist, so there weren't a lot of Erlenmeyer flasks hanging around. I was a physicist, so I had wire chambers. Uh-huh. I was part of a high-energy experiment that we were going to do at CERN, the big atom smasher in Switzerland. So I was working on what are called CHARPAC chambers, and I became kind of the world's expert on CHARPAC chambers. So I was surrounded by wires and electronics and that kind of a thing. But I ate out of vending machines. I didn't spend a lot of time personally grooming. I had no social life. I didn't want a social life. I wasn't interested in the outside world. Really, that lab for me was my world. And so when I was not in that lab, I was in the classroom. And then even then I broke rules, because I got to the point where I became interested in galaxies because of something that was discovered by a guy named P.J. Peebles at Princeton. I won't get into it. So I switched my gears from being interested in high energy physics to being interested in galaxies, which meant I had to learn more astronomy. So I petitioned the physics department. It's a whole story. I was a real trouble child. I caused a lot of trouble at Cornell.
You sound like a wonderful scientific genius. But I guess my question is, what troubled you that made you think maybe there's something beyond this?
This question, Eric. It was a simple question, for goodness sakes. I'm learning. I've devoted my whole life to studying the universe. So there I am, the ultimate pinhead. And I'm about a year and a half into my grad studies, and I'm learning now, because I've now petitioned not just to take physics classes, but I'm taking astronomy classes. And then I had to petition for the math department, because my thesis became so mathematical. So I ended up, that's why I ended up getting a PhD in physics, math, and astronomy. I had members, faculty members from all three departments in my final defensive thesis exam, so they could grill me on any one of these three. Nobody at Cornell had ever done that. I suspect nobody's ever done that since. I was a real problem child. But what it meant is I had this just blazing curiosity, and I was just dead honest. So I asked myself, okay, this incredible universe that I understand now from the subatomic level now to the astronomical level, I had a unique perspective that most grad students didn't. So I said to myself, well, how did this universe? And so, well, it's the standard cosmological model, kid. Buy into it. And I bought into it for a while, but I started poking holes in it, and other people started poking holes in it. So it answered some questions. I'm not like totally trashing the standard cosmological model, please understand, but it didn't answer the ultimate question: who lit the fuse?
Okay, look,
right?
Everything else is detail. And what you're talking about is the role of science, tell me if I'm wrong, is to describe, to say, this happened, and then we discovered this happened in this way, and we're describing what happened from 13.8 billion years ago, roughly, and basically we know, but we we get confused sometimes, but basically we understand these things and we can look at what happened, you know, 10 to the negative 43rd second after the Big Bang. And so we can get into all that. But what you're saying, I guess, is even though we know all that, we don't know what happened before. We don't know what caused it.
What ignited it? What? Yeah, exactly, Eric. What set it all off? Okay, I can buy the quantum vacuum. I can buy the Big Bang. I can buy the inflation. I can buy all that. But what started it? And you have people like Stephen Hawking, God bless him. And you know, I was the first correspondent to interview Stephen Hawking.
You know what? Forgive me, Michael. We're going to go to a break. When we come back, we're going to talk more about all of this very interesting stuff. Stick around.
Hey, get rhythm when you get the blues.
Folks, I'm talking to Dr. Rhythm. Michael Gillen. His new podcast is called Science Plus God with Dr. G. Dr. G, Michael, my friend, let me ask you, you said that you were one of the first correspondents to talk with Dr. Stephen Hawking. Did I get that right?
I was the first television correspondent to interview him because he was very shy at the time. Okay, I was at Harvard. This would have been in the mid 80s when he had just come out with A Brief History of Time, remember, big bestseller, but he had never been interviewed on television, on network television. And so he came to Harvard to give a series of lectures. So I met him then personally while I was teaching at Harvard. So I got to know him then. So when the bestseller came out, and I can't remember whether the bestseller came out before or after he was at Harvard, but anyway, when the book came out, I told my producers at ABC, I said, I'd like to interview Stephen about the book because it was a big bestseller. So he had not granted any interviews up until then. So my producer came back and he says, yeah, he remembers you from Harvard. He's happy to have you fly out to England. You can interview him at his house. I interviewed him, his wife, his young son, Tim, who's probably in his 20s or 30s now. Nobody had ever done that before. And what I found so interesting, and I know this is a little bit of a digression, but there's a point we'll make in a minute. It's an interesting digression. When we got there, what was interesting is that he was living in the basement of a residence hall. And I thought to myself, wow, this is like really weird because he was like the Lucasian professor of mathematics at the university. And this was the chair that was held by Isaac Newton. And I thought to myself, my God, I would have thought they'd give better living quarters to somebody with a Lucasian chair than this, but he was living in the basement. But he was very gracious. And what was interesting is I had to submit my questions ahead of time because he had to program his answers into his voice box. So it was kind of a weird interview because I would ask him a question and then I would just sit there and he'd push the button and we'd both just sit there kind of staring at each other awkwardly while the voice box answers my question. But anyway, it was the reason I brought him up is because, you know, he was an interesting guy. I had a lot of respect for Stephen, a lot of love for Stephen. He kind of blew hot and cold with the God question. One minute he's saying, yeah, the evidence points to God. Next, no, it doesn't really. And at the end, he kind of came down on believing that the universe created itself. He really wanted to avoid God for personal reasons. He just really wanted to avoid believing in God. And so he concocted this idea that, and many people quote him now, to get around this dilemma of what started it all, okay? And his idea was, well, if you imagine a quantum vacuum where there is a gravitational field, then you can show mathematically that quantum vacuum will, if you wait long enough, it will create a universe, okay? But here's a problem with that. Where did the gravitational field come from? Where did the quantum field,
where did the quantum vacuum come from?
That's the problem I was facing as a grad student. And I was honest enough to say, you know what?
If I was looking for a vacuum, I would go to Target, Lowe's, but a quantum vacuum?
I know.
All around the city, and you'd be lucky. You'd be very lucky to find a quantum vacuum that's affordable.
Affordable, especially.
unbelievable.
This is what I love about you, man. I just love you. I love you, brother. So listen. So
thank you. Go ahead.
So when I was a grad student faced with this question that science wasn't giving me an adequate enough answer, and I was honest enough to admit it, I wasn't like all the other lemmings, like, you know, the emperor has no clothes. Like, oh yeah, he has clothes. No, he doesn't. There's a problem here, Houston. And so where do you go? Because my whole life was science. I lived my whole life on the scientific plantation. And then I remember, because I got to know Carl Sagan and I took courses from him on exobiology. I was very fortunate. I was just at the right place at the right time in my career. I've gotten to know these wonderful people.
And this was at Cornell.
Huh?
This was at Cornell you met Sagan.
Yeah, at Cornell, because Sagan was at Cornell at the time, and he was just getting to be well known. He was starting to go on the Johnny Carson show and all that. Anyway, but I took courses from him and Frank Drake, and Frank Drake was on my thesis committee on exobiology. And, you know, Frank Drake was the father of SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. Everybody associates it with Carl because Carl was very upfront, very bombastic, very engaging. Frank, who's still alive, very shy, very withdrawn, but Frank and Carl were a tag team, and so I took courses from them. So I remember that Carl would always talk about the Vedas, you know, and he was a non-believing Jew, okay? But as he
the
talked
Hindu
about
Vedas.
Huh? But he talked about the Vedas. The hint, I didn't know that. I didn't know that because, again, I was just a scientist. I didn't know enough about religions. I didn't care about religions. I didn't care about God. Science was my whole life. So, and this was the days before Google. So I thought to myself, well, what is Carl keep talking about the Vedas? And I'm searching for answers. He's talking about the Vedas. So I went to Olin Library, which is the grad student library there at Cornell. This was before Google. And I looked it up, and lo and behold, hey, it's the sacred literature of the Hindu religion. So I dove right in, like I do everything in life. I thought, hey, this is interesting. If it's good enough for Carl, it's good enough for me. And then a friend of mine gave me a copy of the I Ching because he knew I was, you know, on this quest for answers. And then I remember finding Hermann Hesse, and I fell in love with Hermann Hesse because he had all these intellectual protagonists who were searching for answers, and that was me. I identified with his protagonists, you know, Beneath the Wheel, Siddhartha, all those, Goldmoon and Narcissus, and so forth. And then, so I got into Buddhism, and then I got into transcendental meditation.
Is this the 8 minute or the 7 minute?
Huh?
I have to ask the producers, this is 7 or the 8 minute?
7 minute.
Oh, that means we're out of time. We'll be right back to complete that sentence. Folks, don't go away. Folks, I'm talking to Dr. Michael Gillen. Michael, you were just making a point. We had to go to a break.
Yeah, that I was now in a place where I had not left the scientific plantation, but I had dared to explore outside the scientific plantation, even though both my feet were still squarely in it. So I started exploring Hinduism and Buddhism and transcendental meditation. A guru was making the rounds at the time, and I would go to his seminars. And then my thesis professor, Richard Leboff, was Jewish. And so he started taking me to Shabbat services on Friday. And then I say, that's where I got to love chopped chicken liver. Because after the Shabbat services on Friday, I know you'd love this. I got to tell you this serious story. This is the truth. So Richard, God bless him, would take me to Shabbat services. Okay. And I remember one of the first times he took me to temple, because I was still a pinhead. I wanted to do a calculation. So I open up the only jacket I own, and I take out my paper and pencil to do a little calculation. He says, oh God, no, don't put it away. You're in a temple. My God, you're not supposed to do any work. This is the Sabbath. I said, I didn't know. What do I know?
They have actual rules in the temple, not like evangelical churches where you come in with your coffee and your flip-flops and your iPad. They have
so true.
God. They actually have respect for God. But who am I to judge? Go ahead.
They do. And that's why they don't even spell it out. It's G-D. They don't dare. They think it's sacrilegious to even dare to spell out the whole word. And I loved it. It was a great experience. But afterwards, he would say, let's go have a little nosh at his house. So he would take me to his house. So the first night, it's what we call a little Onik Shabbat. It's a little meal after the Shabbat services. It's not the Shabbat meal, but it's a little Onik Shabbat. It's like a little celebration of the Shabbat services. Okay, anyway, so he takes me there, and he offers me chopped chicken liver. And I said, Richard, my mother tried to fatten me up all my life with fried liver. I hate this stuff. This is my mother's recipe. Try it. I tried it. I loved it. So I learned to love chopped chicken liver, okay? So I explored Judaism. And then one day, serious story, I went to my dorm room. It was about 3 in the morning, typical. I would sleep from about 3 to 6. I opened the door. I heard a scraping sound. I looked down. There's an envelope with my name on it. I open it up, and it's a Valentine's Day card from somebody named Laurel. Number one, I didn't even know it was Valentine's Day. I didn't care it was Valentine's Day, and I'm thinking, Laurel, Laurel Lucas. Oh, I had a student named Laurel Lucas in my Physics for Poets class a couple years earlier. Well, long story short, she comes after me, and she challenges me when I tell her my whole story that I'm searching for an answer to my question, how did the universe begin? And I studied all these religions. She says, well, have you ever read the Bible? You've read the Vedas, and you've read the I Ching and all that. I said, no, not really, for two reasons. Number one, I grew up hearing about the Bible, and I just didn't think it had anything to teach me. It seemed very prosaic. And number two, I had the impression that people who read the Bible hated science. And I happen to love science, so why would I want to read the Bible? Then she said something to me. She said, I haven't read the Bible either. She was a lapsed Catholic, and so not a religious freak. She says, I haven't read it either. If you read it, I'll read it with you. And so I thought, okay, I'm not as stupid as I look. I could spend a little more time with this pretty girl. So we read the Bible. It took us 2 years. And that was a game changer for me. And that was the beginning of when I really started seriously exploring Christianity. And there was something very different about Christianity I discovered. We don't have time to get into it now. I'm working on a book now that's coming out either in the fall or in the spring that will explain some of this. But there was something fundamentally different about Christianity than all the other religions that I had studied. And so it wasn't like I had an immediate conversion. It took me many years, more than a decade, but slowly but surely, because I'm an intellectual still at heart. I'm an intellectual Christian. It took me a long time to finally say, you know what, this is the real deal. And so I understand people today, Eric, who really believe that the science and God are incompatible. I lived that life. Fortunately, I grew out of it. And so my podcast, Science and God, is maybe partly aimed at them, people who've kind of gotten stuck on their journey. They've gotten stuck in a pothole, and they believe this God and God and Christianity. No way, no way, no way, no way. Yeah, there is. Get out of that pothole. But I'm also talking to Christians who maybe hate science, or who suspect science, or who see science as the enemy. No, it isn't. And so, I want to talk to scientists who maybe believe that Christianity has nothing to teach a scientist. So I'm really excited. Just started today. I debuted new episodes.
People should never see science as the enemy. But I think of ninth grade biology as the enemy. I just want to be specific and clear. I hated that class. Okay. But science in general, I'm good with it.
Well, you know what?
Go ahead.
What I say to people all the time is this, because it's interesting. Well, there's so much I could say. I just want to say this. I truly believe that the scientific method is the most brilliant technique we have developed to understand the universe rationally, okay? But it has limits. And more than that, not all scientists are brilliant. So the method is brilliant, but unfortunately, the execution of the method is often flawed. And actually, if we had time, we don't. I have another series on YouTube called Going Viral with Dr. G, and I'm going to be talking about something called the replication crisis. We're finding that most of the scientific publications today cannot be replicated. They cannot be confirmed. And this has led to a major crisis. So there is a reason.
It means it's not actual science, according to the definition of science.
Yes, correct? Exactly. So the scientific method is brilliant. Unfortunately, the execution by scientists is not brilliant, because scientists are humans. And so they're biased. They're sloppy. They can be sloppy. and they can have poor designs. So I just want to encourage people to say that, number one, I believe in the Bible. I remember going, I toured campuses, so I talked to college kids, and I had one college kid come up to me and he said, Dr. Gillen, do you believe in the entire Bible, like the whole thing? And I said, well, let me put it to you this way. There is nothing that I have read in the Bible that I cannot understand or explain, or that is somehow invalidated by anything else that I know, science or otherwise. And so, yeah, I guess the answer to your question is yes, I believe in the entire Bible. And Eric, you're an honest person. I love Socrates in the City, and I love that opportunity to speak there. But I would be the first person to tell you, if I found something that we've discovered in science that's trustworthy, that somehow contradicts the Bible. But I can tell you, and your listeners, quite honestly, there isn't.
I want to ask you some specifics on that when we return. Folks, don't go away. For so long now. Hey, folks, talking to Dr. Michael Gillen. Michael, there's some specifics I want to ask you. When people say, like you, that there's nothing in the Bible that they've read that contradicts science. Now, you are a scientist of the first order. You're not such a focused scientist that you can't see the big picture. You've studied a number of scientific disciplines. So people, of course, have tons of follow-up questions. When you say that, they go, wait a minute, what about the talking snake? What about the, you know, there are many questions that people who are atheists and people who are Christians like myself still have and want to ask people like you. I'll give you an example of what I mean. Some people I know believe in what's called the young earth creation. They say that, you know, it's all about 11,000 years old or something like that. Other people believe in the Big Bang, 13.8 billion years of existence since the Big Bang. Some people believe in theistic evolution. The Biologos Foundation believes in what's called theistic evolution. And then my friends at the Discovery Institute believe in intelligent design. Do you take a position with regard to theistic evolution or intelligent design?
That's a question I'm always asked. And here's my standard reply, because I've thought a lot about this over the decades. That's the one of the first questions I get asked. Here's what I want your listeners and viewers to understand. When I say that there is no fundamental disagreement between science and the Bible, I mean that. And this is what I mean by that. My wife and I have been married for like 28 years, okay? Do we have disagreements? Yes, okay? I like to unroll the paper towels this way. She likes to unroll them this way, okay? I don't mean to make light of a serious topic, but you get the idea. But when it comes to the fundamentals, Laurel and I are completely in sync. And that's the kind of relationship I'm talking about between the Bible and science. So when I say that there is a complete agreement between science and the Bible, this is what I'm talking about. When it comes to the fundamental issues, there is no light between them. There is no disagreement between them. Now, does that mean they have no disagreements? Of course not. They do. For example, you've brought one up in terms of the age of the universe. We believe typically that the universe is maybe about 13.7 billion years old, based on a whole lot of evidence, right? But there are people, young Earth creationists, who believe that it's about 6,000 years old. Now, here's why I don't get all worked up over that. Because, you know, people have big debates, Bill Nye debating with Ken Ham and how old is the universe. Here's why that is silly and a waste of time. What we know from science, and even from the Bible, is that there are different kinds of truths. There are absolute truths that are absolutely true under all conditions, for all people, for all time. Okay, that's what we call absolute truths. But we also know there are relative truths. Okay, we know that in the Bible, and we know that in science. So let me stick with science for a moment. What are the relative truths? Typically, generally speaking, we don't have enough time to go into super detail. I hope maybe for another show we can. But as a rule of thumb, okay, the relative truths tend to fall into four categories: time, space, matter, and energy. Okay. In other words, you and I can disagree about time without us being wrong. We know that from the special relativity. It just depends on the reference frame you're in. So if you're in one reference frame, a second will take a certain amount of time. For me in another reference frame, a second will take a different amount of time. Are you wrong and I'm right? Or am I wrong and you're right? No, you're both right. In other words, these reference frames can be reconciled. They're reconcilable. So any issue having to do with time. So how old is the universe?
Now, listen, you've just taken us to such a deep, amazing subject, but we're at the end of the program. Here's what we're going to do. Here's what we're going to do. If we travel at half the speed of light, actually forget that. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to keep you for the first segment of hour two. So ladies and gentlemen, don't go away. We will continue this conversation with Dr. Michael Gillen. Just all right. Oh, yeah.